morning. It looks like everyone is situated for the next case, which is in the matter of the civil commitment of Joseph Harvey Bellinger, case file A24-0610. We'll hear first from counsel for appellant. Please be sure to introduce yourself for the record before beginning your argument.
Thank you. Sorry, I thought I was situated and I forgot to pull up my brief.
You can take a moment. There's no need for anyone to rush.
Ready now.
Ready?
Yes.
Good morning. My name is Mackenzie Guptill. I'm here on behalf of appellant Joseph Bellinger. May it please the court and counsel. And we are the appellant in this matter, the respondent, patient in the district court matter, in which Mr. Bellinger is now appealing a judgment of a Cass County court filed on February 14th, 2024, committing him as a sexually dangerous person. The main arguments in which we found that the court issued the order of indeterminate commitment pursuant to 253D, specifically finding that he was a sexually dangerous person pursuant to, I believe, 253D.02 subdivision 16, is on a variety or a number of different grounds. First and foremost, that the court heard testimony and received evidence relating to alleged victims of sexual assault, and that there were inconsistent findings of the court on what the burden of proof for the purposes of finding those victims were. Also, whether or not the court, irrespective of that, concluded erroneously based on the facts that Mr. Bellinger acted in a way that was a course of harmful sexual conduct. Additionally, we are arguing that the court erred in finding that he had sufficient inability to control sexual impulses that makes him different or separate from the traditional sexual recidivist offender. And third, we argued that the court erred in determining that Mr. Bellinger was highly likely to reoffend. And so those are the grounds, specifically with regard to the course of harmful sexual conduct. There was evidence or testimony related to four different individuals. And I say evidence or testimony because, as noted in the brief, one of the individuals didn't testify.
So three testified.
That's correct.
The nephew did not.
That's correct.
Okay. And as to the three that testified, do you dispute that the testimony they gave would be relevant to the determination of a course of harmful sexual conduct? In other words, do you dispute that each of them described conduct that is traditionally recognized as the type of conduct that would constitute harmful sexual conduct?
I think that the question, and I apologize, the way that I'm receiving the question, the problem is that it's kind of the way I look at it is nebulous, that there's different pieces of way the court should have taken the analysis. So certainly evidence from these individuals is relevant, the people that testified is relevant to the determination of whether or not Mr. Bellinger engaged in a harmful course. But the concern that exists, first and foremost, is that when the court issued findings, so we'll take out the nephew.
Okay.
But when the court issued a finding as it relates to MAJ, and that was the case where Mr. Bellinger was actually convicted of, I think, third-degree assault and terroristic threats, but there was a dismissal of the crim sexual conduct. In that case, the court issued in the findings section saying that the court found more likely than not that Mr. Bellinger committed the acts, and I think.
Let me stop you there because mm-hmm. I want to stay with you. The state says, well, you only need two to constitute a course. So right away, I'm thinking, all right, the nephew, he didn't testify. What if we just take the nephew out? We're left with three people who testified, claiming
yes.
that they had been subjected to harmful sexual conduct.
Yes.
The district court found all three credible,
mm-hmm.
but as when describing the testimony or the report of one of those witnesses, use language indicating the court used a preponderance of the evidence standard rather than clear and convincing evidence, which
yes.
is the standard we need.
Yes.
All right. The state responds, well, you only need two for a course. We don't have this error about burden of proof regarding the two that did testify. The district court found those two credible. I mean, what's your best argument why the testimony of those two witnesses is not adequate to establish a course, if a course can be established by two?
I think that the overall determinations on everything comes in as it relates to other factors, and I'm concerned about that, so I'm going to go back to that. Because all of that information, I think, is used by the doctors, and then the court, to a certain extent, it would be my view, delegated a substantial view to what the examiners opined. But what I would say with regard...
So what you're suggesting is, well, you can't just take out the nephew's accusations. It's not that simple, because the nephew's accusations factored into all the expert opinions.
Yes, if I may, and let me know when you want me to go back to the other thing, but if I may, the concern that exists is if an evaluator finds more likely than not that information is accurate, if they find that it's more credible than not, they operate on a view of inclusivity. And so, for example, with regard to the Static 99, whether or not you have a male offender is utilized in that risk assessment, and generally, whether or not somebody has a male victim is utilized for the purposes of determining that you're more likely to reoffend. It's an enhanced risk factor. And there's also concerns about whether or not that means that the evaluators determined that he had a sufficient type of deviancy in determining whether or not he was highly likely to reoffend or couldn't control his sexual impulses. And so it all comes in, and it's all concerning as it relates to that nebulous kind of viewpoint. With regard to the course of harmful sexual conduct, the concern that exists is when the court issues more likely than not findings on two specific individuals, and that would be obviously the nephew and then MAJ, and then doesn't make a specific finding in as to the burden of proof in the findings section, then the concern is, was it the intent of the court to issue the same type of standard, or is the court saying, and going back later, the court found that there was clear and convincing, and I think made a specific reference in that. I think as a matter of candor, I referenced that on page 22 of my brief that said that there was a paragraph 274 on page 42 of the court's decision where there was a clear and convincing finding in the conclusion section, but it was inconsistent because it wasn't referenced in the findings section, and that was the concern I had. I would also identify that with regard to CRD, the concern I have on why I think that the findings in that specific victim that testified were erroneous is that in that specific situation, CRD was an ex-girlfriend. I think there was some testimony about the fact that she had memory issues and that she filed an order for protection years before, didn't reference anything with regard to the sexual abuse allegations. And the concern that I have that was, I think, argued in cross-examination of Dr. Komaritis, who was the second court-appointed examiner, and argued in the brief as well as the proposed findings, is number one, whether or not now the testimony and the reflection of that individual is different than what may have happened years before.
But these are credibility arguments, and we're going to defer to credibility determinations, implicit and explicit, and we have explicit credibility determinations.
Yes. Yeah,
so I'm suggesting this probably isn't your strongest argument because it's, especially on live testimony. I mean, there are exceptions where the determination is based on affidavits and whatnot.
Yes.
But
I think that the concern with regard to that specific person is also the idea that if the allegations are that sexual abuse is part of a domestic violence relationship, the concern I have is that I would take the position that most domestic violence relationships have an undertow of individuals not being able to refute, not being able to turn around and say no, not being able to turn around and defend themselves. And to a certain extent, those types of relationships have submissiveness to them. And so the argument is this the type of nature of a relationship that the statute was supposed to be focused on.
But he's also got allegations of kidnapping a couple of girls, strangers, so that's not a domestic situation.
Yes, but those are all used for the purposes of establishing that this person is completely different than your typical recidivist offender. And so I think now, if I may, go to the other things that concern me.
Can I just do one wrap-up question? Because the question that you had was reflecting what I was wondering, which is I appreciate the argument about the standard of proof that it mm-hmm. was talked to, preponderance and then was silent on the other two. But when you have the actual, with respect to the last three at least, victims testifying that this happened to me and that's found credible, how does the burden of proof even factor in, or the standard of proof, I guess? If you find them credible, it's preponderance, it's clear and convincing, it's he did this. I'm trying to figure out how that, does a fact finder decide, I'm mostly or more, more likely than not they're credible, or it's clear and convincing it's credible? How do they interrelate then?
You mean how does the fact, does it really matter if the fact finder finds more likely than not?
Well, they found the people credible who testified mm-hmm. as to what happened to them. And if what they said was true and I believe them, then that's beyond preponderance of the evidence even. It's just I believe this is what happened.
I think the concern, and to a certain extent I apologize because now I'm wheeling back to the idea, as Judge Larkin said, but a couple of these, let's just forget about it then and just focus on the ones where the individuals testified. I think the concern that exists is when the court turns around and issues a credibility finding at one point but then says, I found it more likely than not. That's the inconsistency. So what does that really mean?
I think the question might be, and I apologize, but mm-hmm. Judge Smith's question is causing me to think, what does it matter? It's obviously clear and convincing. If a person took an oath, swore to tell the truth, testified that these things happened, the judge found the person credible. Why isn't that clear and convincing evidence, despite the fact that the judge may have said, use language that suggests a preponderance standard?
Yeah, and I think that...
do we really think the judge was, as Judge Smith said, I guess it's more likely than not? Mm-hmm. once you say, credible, I believe you, that seems to automatically rise to the level of clear and convincing.
And then, counsel, can you answer that question, particularly in the light of the fact that the judge, in their conclusions of law, did find that it's clear and convincing? So you have clear and convincing in the conclusions of law, I believe. A finding of credibility of the witnesses and an inartful discussion that is probably a preponderance in the finding of facts.
Yeah, I think that that's a good opportunity to kind of point out that although it wasn't mentioned in the brief, at volume 3 of the transcript of the trial, so right when we were done, the judge herself had some questions about this actual kind of how does everything really interrelate. And so it's at page 462 and 463. And I think that the concern I have is when I was looking at that, my initial response in the question was that I took the position that the judge was saying, I'm not in a position to tell the evaluators to recode the information. It's whether or not I look at that information and I weigh it. But there was a significant discussion of how the court, maybe not significant, but there was a discussion of how the court is supposed to view the testimony and view the information if the evaluators found those pieces of information credible. And so the concern, the court comes back and says what the court really found was that the people that testified is credible. There's still a concern about whether or not, irrespective of that credibility and irrespective of whether or not that standard was appropriate, how the evaluators interplayed all that information to find that Mr. Bellinger was not a person that could control his sexual impulses and that he was highly likely to reoffend, identifying that he is so different from a recidivist offender. I think that the other part about it is it's certainly understandable that the court says, these people testified and I found them credible. With regard to PAN, this is a situation where there was a criminal prosecution years before, And at the day of trial, all charges were dismissed, except for something that was, I would argue, was unrelated, because it was a drug charge that was related to when he was arrested a couple of days later. And so the concern that exists on why does it matter is that the best evidence for what was going on at that time is at the time that there was a criminal prosecution. And the line that we have to look at in factoring all this information out to say, is this a person that's subject to commitment, is to determine whether or not they are somebody that can be prosecuted in the criminal justice system, deterred by that prosecution, and whether or not, even if they have that deterrent, that they've been prosecuted, sentenced, and there's a risk they're going to reoffend again. I think I'm out of time.
Oh, you could finish your thought.
And so my concern is that as we look at Mr. Bellinger, although he's had criminal punishments, and I would say the criminal punishment, obviously, with regard to MAJ as a result of a criminal sexual conduct allegation, although it wasn't sentenced on that, the bulk of his other criminal sentences didn't have anything to do with criminal sexual conduct charges. So here's an individual that has been part of the system, but is not part of a deterrent from criminal justice related to sexual assaults. And that's the concern. One of the things that I think I tried to argue is the line that has to be figured out is you're so dangerous that you are in a situation where you can't control your sexual impulses the way somebody who's been to prison and can get punished and can get deterred. And with regard to the findings of lack of control, the court was a little vague on that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court, I'm Assistant Attorney General Angela Kiza, appearing on behalf of the respondent Cass County in this case. So you don't get a bonus for being super violent and sexually violent. In this case, yes, Mr. Bellinger has a super, super violent history against all people in all kinds of ways. What that includes is a sexually dangerous history. And he has reoffended sexually multiple times since he was initially prosecuted for sexually abusing his nephew when he was 18 years of age and his nephew was 11 years of age. And with respect to that particular victim, I would note there was some discussion about that in appellant's argument. The experts did testify that there was a course of harmful sexual conduct, whether or not his nephew was included in that course of harmful sexual conduct.
Can I ask some questions on the topic of the course of harmful sexual conduct? In your brief on page 17, you refer to his sex-related convictions.
Yep.
And then on page 34, 35, you said after he served prison time for his first sex-related conviction offense.
Yep.
What sex-related convictions did he have?
MAJ was a sex-related conviction because he was charged with 8 counts of criminal sexual conduct before he pled guilty to the terroristic threats and the third-degree assault, so that's considered a sex-related conviction. The DOC, that's why they recommended sex offender treatment.
And why is something a sex-related conviction if it's not a criminal sexual conduct conviction? If it's, I don't hear
that's
a conviction.
That's why I said sex-related versus criminal sexual conduct, because it's sex-related because in the initial complaint he was charged with 8 counts of criminal sexual conduct in addition to all of the other offenses that occurred when he was sexually assaulting her. So that's the DOC considers that a sex-related conviction. That's why, if you look in the records, that's why they considered him and recommended that he go to sex offender treatment. And that's why they considered him he's required to register for that. That's why they considered him for end of confinement review before his release from prison, because it's a sex-related conviction because of the charges.
Okay, so even if there's not a conviction on a sex crime, you consider a sex-related conviction if those charges are dismissed as part of a plea, which is, I assume, what happened, right?
Correct.
That you still count.
That's still
CSCs
considered a sex-related conviction purposes under the DOC.
You need to let the judge finish. We can't have you talking over.
Okay, sorry about that.
Yeah. Okay.
Let me follow up with that. We don't need proof beyond a reasonable doubt of prior harmful criminal sexual conduct. So we don't need any convictions, right?
No, no, you don't need any convictions. The standard of proof is clear and convincing evidence. There doesn't have to be clear and convincing evidence for every offense. In this case, I would argue, though, that based on the court's findings, based on the credibility findings, and based on the ultimate findings, that there was, the court did find clear and convincing evidence on each of the four victims in this case. And keep in mind, too, that I believe every victim reported repeated sexual assaults against that victim. So even the individual victims, to the extent they were clear and convincing, would be sufficient for a course. His nephew reported, I think, several sexual assaults over a course of time. MAJ reported that he sexually assaulted her first at the cemetery and then later repeatedly sexually assaulted her at his mother's home. PAN reported that he sexually assaulted her one night and then repeatedly sexually assaulted her the following night. His ex-girlfriend reported that he sexually assaulted her repeatedly throughout the course of their relationship, and I think the judge described it as off and on in the judge's findings. And with respect to the clear and convincing standard, as Mr. Gupta pointed out, if you look at, to me, the important section on this and the findings is on page 42, under 274 through 278. That's where the court has the subheading, course of harmful sexual conduct that creates a substantial likelihood of serious or physical or emotional harm. She points out he hasn't been convicted, but the evidence in the record, including the testimony at trial, establishes by clear and convincing evidence the respondent committed the sexual offenses with which he was charged. Okay, that covers three. He was charged with three of those four victims. And then, as we already discussed, the court found that he committed first and third degree criminal sexual conduct with his ex-girlfriend, too, and she found her testimony credible. And the court said, these offenses establish a course of harmful sexual conduct. Then in the next finding, again, she cites the clear and convincing standard. There's also clear and convincing evidence that respondents' victims experienced serious physical and emotional harm as a result of his offending. Respondent used force to penetrate his victims, including anally. He used physical force, threats, and intimidation to control his victims. Three of his victims credibly testified regarding the significant psychological trauma. And then the court also cites two other typical harm that the experts testified about and opined about. So, I mean, this isn't even a close case on whether there is a course of harmful sexual conduct here. There are a couple of parts, you know, a couple of paragraphs in the actual victim section, yeah, where the court says more likely than not, but I don't think there's, when you look at the findings as a whole, I don't think there's any question that this court found the victims credible and found that there was a court clear and convincing evidence of a course of harmful sexual conduct.
If a district court cites one correct standard and one incorrect, why should we believe that the district court is applying the correct one?
Well, for one thing, she never said anything about preponderance of the evidence. I don't believe she ever used those words. I think she said more likely than not in a couple parts in her thing.
So is it more likely than not a preponderance standard?
It is, but I'm saying she didn't cite that when she was talking about the standard of proof, what I just quoted from the findings. She repeatedly said clear and convincing evidence.
But in the findings, she also repeatedly, in different sections, said more likely than not, which I would argue that, I would presume this court could interpret that as a preponderance standard. So again, to Smith's question, when we have a court saying that there's a preponderance finding and making a clear and convincing finding on the same thing, how do we reconcile that inconsistency?
Well, the couple of times where she made those preponderance findings were within the specific victim sections, and as I said, it's clear when you look at the record as a whole that she found those victims credible and that they were part of the course of harmful sexual conduct. But when you look at the actual findings on course and the conclusions of course, she uses the correct standard repeatedly. And That's, to me, those are the most significant findings because those are on the actual element that we were required to prove and that we did prove through the victim testimony
counsel,
at trial.
Counsel, I guess, looking at the order, you're calling them findings, but they're in the conclusion of law section. So she makes conclusions of law that they prove it by clear and convincing evidence. She does that as a group. She doesn't individually say that each victim, I think, and I'm looking at finding 274 and 275. In the findings of the fact, she individually, with each individual, or at least two of the individuals, uses a preponderance standard. Again, how do we reconcile that inconsistency, particularly in the fact that in the finding of fact section, she uses the preponderance standard for a specific victim, and in the conclusion of law section, she just uses it generally for everyone else?
Well, so I respectfully disagree with your statement about that. 274 is a finding of fact. The conclusions of law don't start until page 52, and then on that, on the first conclusion of law, she says the state has proven by clear and convincing evidence we met the criteria. But all the things that I read to you earlier from 274 on, those are part of the findings of fact. She made specific findings of fact on each element.
But she makes specific findings of fact that are contradictory, and you're not getting to the answer to the question, how do we reconcile the inconsistencies in the findings of fact?
And how you reconcile them is that her specific findings of fact on the element, of course, of harmful sexual conduct that creates a substantial likelihood of serious physical harm, she repeatedly says clear and convincing evidence. So looking at the overall course, she found clear and convincing evidence of a course of harmful sexual conduct. So,
counsel, why do we have to reconcile it? I'm just being practical here. Is there any reason we can't remand to the district court saying you've made inconsistent findings, we don't know, people are concerned that you lumped everything into the clear and convincing category even though you use language suggesting preponderance of evidence, would you address this on remand and tell us what you found?
I mean, I don't think you need to remand it. I think it's clear that the evidence,
I'm not asking
you know,
whether you think,
but
I'm asking,
could
is there
you?
Anything that prevents that?
I don't think there's anything that prevents that, and I, you know, if you want to remand it, I think that she would clarify that. I mean, I, you know, it's a couple of unfortunate sentences in a beautiful long order that clearly supports all the elements for commitment. So, I don't.
We do want people to have faith and confidence in the district court's orders, especially when it's an order committing someone to what is usually recognized as a lifetime commitment. So is it too much to ask that a district court judge not reference inconsistent standards which give people, particularly the person who's subject to the commitment, reason to question whether the right standard was in fact used? I'm not suggesting that the inconsistencies necessarily mean reverse the commitment, but I just wonder if the prudent course wouldn't be to send it back to say, would you please clarify the burden that you used in determining whether or not the incident against MEJ was proved by clear and convincing evidence?
You certainly could do that. I just think it's very obvious that the court, like I said, in the essential, I think that's how you reconcile it. I think in the essential findings, the court is very clear that it's clear and convincing evidence. She says there's clear and convincing evidence specifically of the charged cases, which are three of the four victims.
Your other argument is, well, you don't need the allegations against the nephew, and the experts apparently said we don't even need to consider those. We could set those aside, and we still reach the same conclusion. I think your argument in your brief went further and said, well, you only need two incidents, so technically you don't. You can take out MEJ's testimony, and you're left with two witnesses who testified, and the judge found that their testimony contributed to clear and convincing evidence of a course of sexual conduct. And as you point out today, their testimony described multiple incidents, so it's not just, you know, two incidents, two victims, it's two victims with multiple incidents.
Correct. So from the standpoint of, is the evidence sufficient in this case? On clear and convincing, of course, it seems to me that given the law and given the facts and the evidence in this case, it would just be affirmed because it's clear and convincing evidence on all the elements. And I think the order is thorough on that issue. Could this court, if it wasn't comfortable that there's not clear and convincing evidence, if you take out the, you know, if those two lines where she says that are bothersome, where she says more likely than not, then certainly you could remand it for clarification. I don't have any doubt that the court would clarify that there was clear and convincing evidence of a course of harmful sexual
conduct. But your argument is we don't need to do that because right. Even if we ignore the nephew and MEG, J and the contradictory
right.
statements regarding burden of proof, there's still enough evidence in this record to constitute clear and convincing evidence of a course of harmful sexual conduct.
Right.
Then do you say to the argument, well, doesn't that call into question the experts' opinions because if they treated MEJ as, you know, this happened and it's not really been proved, does that impact their opinions and affect the weighing of their opinions?
Well, I mean, as Mr. Gupta pointed out, he had the opportunity and did question the experts about all of those things at trial. The court took all of that into consideration when the court made its findings. And again, I think the court's credibility findings and findings on clear and convincing evidence are sufficient to sustain and affirm the court below.
He also challenges whether or not the highly likely to sexually reoffend prong is satisfied. Do you want to address that?
I do. I'm out of time. Is it, may I proceed or?
30 seconds.
Okay. I think it's, if you look at the court's findings on that issue, that's something that the court considered, for the lack of control, considered the diagnosis and how they relate to his lack of control. And as I pointed out earlier, he lacks control both with respect to general criminal and with respect to criminal sexual conduct.
And we need to focus on the criminal sexual conduct here.
Yes.
Okay.
And as far as the highly likely element is concerned, the actuarial tools are that the experts use generally do go to the highly likely for criminal sexual conduct. He was very high on all of those tools. In addition, they address dynamic risk factors, which are empirically associated with risk, and any protective factors that would apply. And all of those things indicated, as the court found, by clear and convincing evidence that he was highly likely to reoffend sexually. The high psychopathy that they looked at means that he's likely to reoffend more quickly, both violently and sexually, than your typical non-psychopathic offender. The experts testified about that deviance and psychopathy correlates with significant faster and higher rates of sexual recidivism. And then I would note, too, that the court, you know, if you look at the language and ints on that, as far as the statistics go, and some of the things that Mr. Gupta raised in his briefs, those, again, are things that he questioned the experts about at trial, and they explained why they relied on the various tools and the research, and that the Inns Court specifically says that the district court's free to determine the weight to attribute to any particular evidence, including predictions of future short or long-term recidivism rates, which the court did in this case.
Judge Larkin, may I ask one more question?
Of course.
Thank you. Is the determination of whether a course of harmful sexual conduct exists, that's a factual determination, finding a fact?
Well, it's a mixed factual and legal determination.
Because I'll ask you my question. Mm-hmm. If a district court finds a course based on four instances and we take out two of them, isn't it fact-finding on our part if we said, well, these two would also constitute it? How can we do that as an appellate court? It seems like we don't know how they relate to it. I mean, we could look at the record and say, yeah, they are close enough. They, you know, look at the details. But it sounds like a fact question to me, that we'd have to find a fact to say two was enough. Or, sorry, two constitutes a course. There is a course based on only two of them.
Right. Well, I think that the application of the facts to the statute is a mixed, I guess, factual and legal determination. So if you know the facts are there and you know that legally that meets a course, it seems like that's a legal determination.
This is why I keep thinking about remand here, because as appellant's counsel has said, all of this factors into the ultimate decision whether or not to commit somebody. So while we could go, well, yeah, the law says you only need two to have a course, and we have clear and convincing evidence of two, therefore we have a course, you know, then we'd have to can then step into the shoes of the district court and say, well, now how does that affect of our assessment of all the other information? How does that affect our assessment of the experts? It just seems that this might be one of those errors that requires the district court to clarify and take a look at everything again, because it is all interrelated.
And I don't think, based on the court's ultimate findings, of course, that that's necessary. And I would ask the court to affirm, but certainly up to you. Thank you very much.
Going off of, I think, what was a very substantial discussion about the findings of fact and the weight of credibility, I made a representation to a transcript that I would ask the panel to look at. And I said it was 462 to 463, and I was incorrect. It's actually page 461. And I have that, and if it's possible, for the brief paragraph, I'd ask permission to read that, because I think it really explains the concern that exists. And so what it says, beginning on line one or line two of 461, it says, from the court, there is a suggestion, because the overall burden in the case is clear and convincing, that I would need to make a finding on whether a crime that was charged and later dismissed, whether there is evidence to support that by clear and convincing evidence. The evaluations and the tools have been admitted that clearly allow the evaluators to make a determination on that standard that I would say is below probable cause to support a complaint, or at least at that. I think Dr. Lindman pretty clearly testified that she views the complaint as meeting that standard, and the language in the tool is even, I think, softer than a probable cause standard. Then the judge specifically says, clear and convincing obviously doesn't get you there.
Well, with the experts, I mean, the experts do their work before the allegations are proved by clear and convincing evidence. That's a trial issue for the district court. So how does, like, the clear and convincing evidence versus preponderance evidence have any relevance to the experts' work? I mean, they've already done their work when they come to trial.
The concern, and not to really paraphrase Ince wrongly, because I take a different view of what Ince says, which is that you've got to do a really good job meeting all this information out and giving from the district court, when I say you, and understanding that experts are going to testify, but you have to independently figure this out, identify the weight you're giving them, and identify the facts. And the concern is, and I'm going from memory on what I thought former Justice Page said during the oral argument events, a lot of it is concern about whether or not the court delegates the experts. And so to unpack it more, the experts look at information under inclusivity. Dr. Doherty, specifically at the trial, said that he erred on the side of public safety. And so if the court turns around and defers what the evaluators found and then says that that's enough because the evaluators found it without looking at the individual information, then the concern is, how do we unpack whether or not he is so different from your recidivist, a typical recidivist offender, that he's either highly likely or that he can't control his sexual impulses? And I say it both ways, because Hendricks took the position that the U.S. Supreme Court said the states can define the statutes for sexual predator laws however they want, but the bottom due process kind of floor is, are we committing people that have been that could be deterred from criminal prosecution? And that's it.
I don't think he could be deterred by criminal prosecution. He went to prison, got out, and reoffended.
Again, the problem that I think exists is he got convicted of criminal prosecution related to something that was charged as a sexual crime, was pled. And again, to clarify, there was an amended complaint. The amended complaint didn't just charge him with 8 or 9, it was 18 counts. And he pled guilty to terroristic threats and third degree criminal sexual conduct. Then if the court was to find that PAN happened, and again, there's arguments on whether or not it did based on the findings, whether or not it was clearly erroneous, but if that incident didn't happen, Mr. Bellinger's last criminal offense.
But your argument that the PAN incident didn't happen has to do with credibility determination. There's no assertion that the district court applied the wrong burden of proof with regard to PAN, who testified at the trial.
I think the difficulty is that, not to continue to be repetitive, I don't know what the district court used for that for that determination. Whether,
so why wouldn't we reverse it and have the district court tell us and to clarify its order?
I think that's what should be done, given the fact that all of this is interrelated. It's all part of an interrelation in finding a determination of whether or not somebody's so different from a typical recidivist offender, and that's the floor. And we can't figure that out, which is why it should get remanded or reversed. Thank you.
Additional questions from the panel? All right. Thank you.
Thank you for your time. All right.